Thanks to my producer, Faith Waddle, and our studio manager in London's broadcasting house, Andy Rushton.
Our composer of the week fled first the Russian Revolution, then a grueling concert schedule in America, then the outbreak of war in 1930s Europe. Despite not being able to put down roots anywhere for long, he found time to produce works such as this. And this. And this is Calling Card, which he grew to despise. Rachmaninoff is Composer of the Week for the 150th anniversary of his birth. Join me, Donald MacLeod, this Monday to Friday at noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday, and next, Private Passions. Michael Barclay's guest is the actor Robert Powell.
Robert Powell needs little introduction. He's one of our best-known actors, with a career that began in the late 60s and exploded into almost instant fame. Since then, there have been some 50 films, including the likes of 39 Steps and The Italian Job, numerous theatre roles and television appearances, which included 6 years on Holby City. For many of us, I expect, he'll always be Gustav Mahler, thanks to Ken Russell's eccentric 1973 biopic, or even Jesus Christ, thanks to his starring role in Zeffirelli's six-hour epic. Well, more on playing Jesus later, but to the music, Robert, and you clearly do love music. You've brought Stravinsky, Bach, Janáček, Bob Dylan, but we start with Mahler and the Adagietto of his Fifth Symphony. And do you feel it takes you to the soul of Mahler, this piece?
I mean, yes, I do, very much so. We played the music on set while we were working. We actually, obviously we didn't record it on set, but we played it when we were setting up scenes. And I'd run through all the symphonies when I was asked to play it to familiarise myself with his work, because I didn't really know it. And I still think to this day it's one of the most moving pieces of music.
Music from the fourth movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 5, with Bernard Haitink conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra in that 1970 recording. Now, you had to do some pretty extraordinary things when you played Mahler, Robert. At one point, you undergo a baptism of fire and blood. You were shut in a glass coffin. What did you think of the extraordinary things that Ken Russell's asking you to do? And what was the most extraordinary?
Well, it was to swim out in... And this was not midsummer. To swim out into... No, they took me out on a boat into the middle of Derwent and chucked me off. Because he wanted a shot of me floating on the water, just gazing up at the sky so he could put music to it. But which is all very well, that's fine. But I'm now, I don't know, about 100 yards out, maybe a bit more. And it is freezing cold. And of course, I can't splash around because I know that Ken is filming. But I've got no way of knowing when he's going to stop. So I'm just lying there hoping I don't die. And eventually I hear the splish and splosh of some oars coming towards me behind me. And somebody came out to rescue me and dragged me into the boat and took me to the shore, where it took about 30 minutes to stop shivering.
Well, of course, you weren't the only one to be put through his paces or her paces, because your co-star, Georgina Hale, who played Alma Mahler, she had to writhe around in a chrysalis, didn't she?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's the other opening sequence. Yeah, he does do that a lot. When we did Tommy, I had to swim naked in a stream. Again, this was not midsummer. This, I think, was October, with Anne Margaret. And I've got to say, if you're going to have to swim around with somebody naked, then Anne Margaret is not a bad bet, really, because she was absolutely divine. So you can't say no. This is it.
I was going to say, did you ever argue with him about what he was asking for? No, not from what you...
No, actually, I didn't.
How do you feel that the Mahler film has lasted? I mean, do some scenes strike you as being inspired by genius, but others as being looking a bit silly now?
All Ken's films were a mixture of the crass and banal and genius. They were moments of absolute magnificence, sprinkled with pretty crass moments, to be honest with you. But I think that's why we enjoyed watching it. And you forgave him for the slight missteps that he took. But the music holds everything. All Ken's films, the music is a cement that holds them together.
Well, your next music now is Janáček, the extraordinary, blazing sinfonietta. I think this is one of the first pieces of classical music that you came across.
Mm.
Why do you think it stayed with you?
I can't remember how I even heard it, because I didn't come from a particularly musical family. We didn't play music around the house. I remember we had a piano. I don't even know why we had a piano, because none of us could play it. And a little sort of dansette record player. And I don't know how I came across it, but I remember hearing it and got absolutely exalted. It's the brass. It's that fanfare that just went, da, 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 da. It just blew me away. And ever since then, I then got a copy and played it all the time. I think it drove my mother mad.
Well, let's hear it, because it's so uplifting. And this fanfare, as you say, there's a huge brass section with no fewer than 9 trumpets.
Thank you.
It's fantastically exhilarating.
Isn't it just?
And we both started moving when he doubles up the time. Ba-da-da-da-da.
But you can imagine how to... I think I can't remember how... But I was about probably 16. 16s and terribly impressionable. And as I say, didn't come from a very musical background at all. And I don't know where my music came from. I sang in the choir at Manchester Grammar School. I sang in a special choir until my voice broke. But when it broke deep. And I didn't fully understand about these kind of things. I thought my voice had turned into a baritone or whatever, and it didn't sound terribly good, so I stopped singing after that.
Simon Rattle conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in the first movement of Janáček's Sinfonietta. You started out as an actor pretty early, didn't you, Robert Powell?
Yeah, well, I started when I was very young. We had little reading prizes at school, and I won them all. And then I did a little plays at my primary school. And when I went to Manchester Grammar School, they put some faith in me, and we did Molière's Scapin. And I was 12 years old, and they cast me in the lead. And this is never done. A school play was always the sixth formers who were playing the leads. And this 12-year-old boy, my first part, was playing the lead in Scapin. And I discovered something, which I think all actors know, is that on stage was more real to me than real life. On stage, I was completely, totally, even at an early age, at home. It felt I could hide. The shy boy that I was then, still am, but I managed to hide it. I learned how not to be shy by being on stage. By being someone else. And I got completely hooked. And from then on, at the school, I managed to get a couple of A-levels in Latin and Greek. But I don't really know how.
Your parents probably weren't mad keen about you becoming an actor.
I don't think they were never going to object. I can't remember them objecting that much, to be honest with you. My mother worked in a bank, and then she met my father when she was 29, and she stopped work.
Housewife?
She was a housewife.
And your father, what did he...
My father was a mechanical engineer. He started off in the floor of an engineering works on a lathe as an engineer, and he ended up as managing director. He was an extremely clever engineer, but that's all he was. I mean, he was just an engineer. So I had no background at all. My brother was a physicist, so I was the only person I knew. Oh, it's not strictly true, actually. One of our neighbours was the headmaster at Salford Grammar School, who stopped me in the street one day, and he said, Robert, he said, I've got a lad at my school. He said, I'm going to send him to RADA. I think he's rather good. I said, you may come across him one day. And I said, oh, who's that? He said, Albert Finney, his name is. And by extraordinary coincidence, my mother used to go to the same hairdresser as Albert's mum, and they used to swap stories about it. And Albert and I became great friends.
Stravinsky next, and The Soldier's Tale, a dark folk tale about a soldier, a princess, and the devil. It's written for actors, dancers, and instrumentalists. And I think you once played the devil when a video was made of this.
I did, yes. This is going back a long time. This is going back to, it's certainly 40 years. But the music stayed, absolutely. Well, if you're all day long, I'm listening to it when we were shooting.
It's a version of the Faust legend, which Stravinsky premiered in 1918. We're going to hear The End and The Devil's Triumph, and you've chosen a 1961 recording conducted by Stravinsky himself.
Before you changed, you can't be anymore. You can't add what you've now become to what you were before. Can't have everything. That's not allowed. One happiness is all the happiness you get. And two's a crowd. As they were lying in their bed. The princess said, "You haven't told me yet what your life was like before we met." I have to say, it all seems long ago. My soldiering, the life I used to know, my village and my dear old mother, so long ago it seems, so far away. In fact, we could be there in half a day.
What if we went there now?
We're not allowed to go.
We could cross the border and hurry back. Who would ever know?
She looks at him. She says to him,
"You know you want to too."
She looks at him, she smiles at him, and he says, "Come here, you."
"No, not unless you say yes. Then I'll lie with you." "Not unless you say yes." "No, not until you do."
"Maybe this time my mother will know me."
"Why not?
It's worth a go. And then she could show me the love and affection a mother needs to show. If she'd agree to come home with me, life would be perfect indeed. Son, wife and mother, all loving each other. What more could anyone need?" So off they went. Long before they were there, they heard the village chimes peal through the air. They saw the steeple not so far away, and in the distance heard the children play. The soldier ran ahead so he could find the frontier post. The princess lagged behind. He crossed, then he called to her, then called again. Suddenly, he turned around, and then the devil jumped out in front of him. He had the violin. He starts to play as the soldier lowers his head and begins to follow him, slowly but obediently. A voice calls in the distance, and for a moment the soldier pauses. But the devil waves him on.
Thank you.
Igor Stravinsky conducting the Columbia Chamber Ensemble in music from his theatrical work, The Soldier's Tale, a recording made in 1961 with a newly recorded narration by Jeremy Irons. As an actor, Robert Powell, you achieved fame pretty early. Do you think there was a downside to that? I mean, was it bewildering? Did it lead you into various temptations, being something of a pin-up? Or do you just think, well, thank goodness?
It's curious. Memory is a really weird thing. I can't ever remember. I hear young people now, I think the most famous was David Beckham, when asked what his ambition was years ago, and he said he wanted to be a famous footballer. And God, that rang a bell. And I thought, no, you don't. You want to be a good one, not a famous one. You cannot have that as an ambition. And I can honestly say that as a young actor, fame was the last thing. I became an actor because I just wanted to act. When I came to London, I was like everybody else, completely out of work. And then I got a job auditioning for... I did bits and pieces, but then suddenly the BBC asked me if I would go and see a director for a Wednesday play, for the lead in a Wednesday play. Yeah, you see, it is early. I was 23, you know, which is early for a young actor, with no training, none. I applied to go to RADA when I came out of rep when I was 21 and came to London. I actually applied. I realised how little I knew. I mean, I knew nothing. I was so naive. And I knew nothing about the technique of acting at all. I just did it. So I applied to RADA and I got through the first exam and then failed to get in. So at 23, I went to get this audition for this Wednesday play and I got it. And it was from that moment, to be honest with you, because obviously bearing in mind in 1967, we didn't have 500 channels. So when a Wednesday play went out, or when anything went out, the water cooler moment was still existed. When I did Doomwatch a couple of years later, we had 13, 14 million viewers, a quarter of the population watching it. So fame came quite easily. When I say came quite easily, it just was unavoidable because you're walking down the street and said, oh, you were on telly last night. So yes, no, I don't think it did. Now, I'm not going to lie. I was in my 20s. I was single. I was not profligate particularly, I don't think. But I did quite enjoy the sweet shop that was presented to me as a result of being an actor in the era of the 60s where there were a lot of very lovely young ladies around, and my old buddy, late buddy now, Dennis Waterman, and I, we took advantage. And, I mean, in the nicest possible way, we didn't take advantage, never. But between us, we had quite a lot of fun.
Well, I think, as Michael Palin would say, say no more.
Say no more.
did you ever talk to yourself about why it was that you so loved being someone other than yourself?
I tried to analyse it to an extent. I was very shy. But I wasn't shy when I was on stage. It just all went away. I was nerveless.
You're in control.
In total control.
Bob Dylan next, who certainly knew what he was doing. You've had a lifelong passion for him, haven't you?
My entire youth from the 60s onwards was really occupied by Dylan. My parents weren't socialists. My father was leaning that way, but my mother was pretty blue, Tory. But this is where I found my politics, really, through Dylan. It was all about injustice and that kind of thing. And I just, even now, I know people are not very kind about him now. And I no longer buy his music, but I've got 10 albums at home.
It must be difficult to choose one. What are you going to home in on?
And I don't know why this one resonated so much. It's Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. And the other thing, too, is I know the French version because my girlfriend of my time in the 60s, she was half French, and she gave me a copy of Hugo Frey sans Skiffle Group singing the same thing. A quoi ça sert de chercher la comprendre? Quand c'est fini, c'est fini. Quand le soleil se levera demain, je serai déjà loin, très loin. Il faut me quitter en chemin. N'y pense plus, tout est bien. And that is 50 years ago, and I remember every word of it, and it's a foreign language. So that was how powerful his lyrics were. He's wonderful.
Well, he's going to find it hard to upstage your French version, but let's hear him anyway.
Thank you. Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right. And it ain't no use in a-turning on your light, baby, the light I never knowed. And it ain't no use in turning on your light, baby, I'm on the dark side of the road. But I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. But we never did too much talking anyway. But don't think twice, it's all right. Calling out my name, gal, like you never done before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking and a-wondering, walking down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I am told. I give her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right. So long, honey, baby, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, baby, so I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. But don't think twice, it's all right.
That's really vintage Dylan, isn't it? 62.
It is. I still think, and hearing it now, because I've not played it for a while, I don't think that's been bettered. What he says, so simply, without shouting, without screaming, and without doing anything, he tells a story. And I think that I gave you my heart, but you wanted my soul.
Don't think twice, it's all right, Bob Dylan's 1962 song. A love song, really, of a kind, but a song which is also full of aggression against the lover, isn't it?
I think in the title, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. Don't worry. Mm. Don't worry. It didn't work. It didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is you wanted more from me than I was prepared to give.
Your own love story, Robert, which did work, began when you met your wife, Barbara, backstage at the BBC. She was a member of the 1970s dance group Pan's People, probably the most glamorous young women on television with their weekly appearances on Top of the Pops. In fact, I had some friends who turned on Top of the Pops just to see Pan's People. You too, yes. You must have been a bit daunted.
Well, I mean, I had... Dennis and I used to watch Top of the Pops every Thursday night. We met very young, Dennis Waterman and I. We met when he was 18 and I was 21 in London. And as I say, we were working at the Royal Court and we had the sweet shop of the King's Road in the 60s. Hey, can't be bad. But Dennis and I used to meet up on a Thursday evening to watch Top of the Pops because we both loved music. rock and roll. We're both passionate about music. And we're watching it, and always Pan's People came on. And I remember sitting there with Dennis in the mid-60s. And every time they come, I go, God, I really fancy the blonde. I don't know. And then, you know, you move on or whatever, and you have another life. And then I remember quite vividly the time. It was 1974. And a friend of mine who worked on Sports Night went on Wednesday night at the BBC. He was the floor manager, and he was a really close mate. And we were talking on the phone. He said, why don't you pop by one day and, you know, come in and have a drink? So I trotted up to the sixth floor bar to meet my chums. And then I spotted these girls walking in. And I said, look, it's Pan's People. And he went, yes, he said, they record on a Wednesday night, so they're here every Wednesday as we are. I said to him, I don't know how to do this. Will you come with me? We had a little favourite restaurant on King's Road, Osteria 430. And I said, I'm going to invite them out to dinner after they've finished tonight. But I can't do it on my own. Will you come with me? Because he knew them all. And he said, yeah, sure. So I invited them. I didn't expect all of them to say yes, but they did. So suddenly...
So they chaperoned.
Yeah. So to cut a long story short, I went back home and prepared myself and went back to the Beeb for 9 o'clock when I knew they would finish recording. And we all met up. And I said to Babs, does anybody want a lift? I said, if you want to leave your car here, you know, I'll take you down to King's Road. And she said, yeah, okay. And we have been together ever since, from that evening. And it's 48 years now.
Children and grandchildren.
Children and grandchildren. So here we are, all these years later, we're still together.
We're going to hear Jacques Lussier now and his take on Bach. You're a fan of his albums, aren't you?
Yeah. I can't remember how or why, but yeah, I've got all his stuff. And I'm not sure why I chose De Carter and Fugue. I suppose it's because, in many ways, I chose it because it's the most obvious. And because it's so well known, it's quite nice hearing it played slightly differently.
Thank you.
every time I hear, and just listening to the music today, the same thing goes through my mind. How do they do it? Because it is so far beyond me.
We heard the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed in the inimitable style by the Jacques Lussier Trio. And by the way, full details of all the music choices of my guest today, Robert Powell, are available if you search on the Private Passions website. And if you go to BBC Sounds, there are hundreds of past programmes to download. It's a strange thought, Robert, that for many people who were around in the late 70s, you will be their image of Jesus, thanks to Zeffirelli's six-hour television epic. Millions of people around the world watched it, including the Pope, who officially endorsed it. I wonder whether you find it still the image of you that people immediately think of, and whether that's been a burden, maybe a pleasant one, at all.
I didn't want to do it. When they asked me originally, my agent rang and said, I knew it was being cast, because lots of my friends were going up for various parts in it. But I didn't want anything to do with it, really. Any part you take on as an actor, there is always a possibility of reaching the peak. You never do, but you have to have that ambition. You have to have that dream of being able to reach the heights with any part you play. But you cannot do that with Jesus. The most you're ever going to do is get away with it. That's the most you can expect.
Did you have to prepare in any special way?
Well, I tried. Well, I read the Bible, obviously, which I wasn't that familiar with, but that was no help at all. There are no descriptions which says Jesus said laughingly or anything. There's nothing like that. There are no clues whatsoever. None. Just the opposite.
You married just before filming the role of Jesus, and it was said at the time that this was so that you wouldn't be seen as living in sin, because you couldn't really have Jesus living in sin.
Well, yeah, it wasn't true. No, Babs and I had already decided. And in fact, when I got the job, I said to her, I said, you know, before we even got out, I said, will you marry me? Because I'm going to have to go away for quite a long time. And I would really love to have that solidity. And we went off and got married very, very privately by special license.
Did you find, from immersing yourself in this role and this story, that anything sort of spiritual rubbed off on you, that it made you think in any different way?
Not really, no. It convinced me that the man existed, that's for sure. There were a couple of moments when we were filming when something extraordinary happened that I can't put and would not even think of ascribing to anything out of this world. But we were doing the Sermon on the Mount. It was a long, long take. It was 8 minutes. On a hill, we were in Morocco, and it had to go at exactly 5 to 4 because the sun set and was just going by the top of the hill. The sun would just be literally disappearing. We started. And I've got about several hundred extras all in front of me on the hill. But I looked at them and I thought, well, they can't hear me. So I raised my voice. And as I raised my voice, the echo came back from the other side of the valley. And it took me so by surprise, I actually started to cry. Because the meaning of the words, and all these little upturned faces all looking at me and listening to these words, the most profound thing that has ever been written about man's humanity to man is the Sermon on the Mount. And 7 minutes later, I hear a voice in the distance shout, cut. And Pippo Pisciotto, the first assistant, came up and he said, Robert, the entire camera crew are in floods of tears. And I don't know quite what happened in that 8 minutes, but
something did.
Something did.
Well, we're going to Argentina next with the composer Ariel Ramirez and his Missa Criolla from 1964. Why do you think this struck such a chord with you?
I think I had heard it originally. It would probably be 79-80 when I was first in Buenos Aires promoting Jesus of Nazareth and 39 Steps. And it just stayed. And as soon as I got back to England, I bought a copy. And it's stayed ever since.
voz. Señor, ten piedad de nosotros.
The Kyrie from Missa Criolla by Ariel Ramirez, with Ricardo Hagman conducting the Estudio Coral Buenos Aires. The vocalist was Mercedes Sosa. It's a strange jump, Robert Powell, from playing Jesus to playing the man who runs the hospital in Holby City. But that's an actor's life.
Well, the nonsense to all that was that when my agent rang and said, out of the blue, she said, I've had a BBC on interested in you doing Holby City. And I said, forget it, no. And she said, well, it's to play a nurse. Really? She said, yeah. And I went, ah. And suddenly I was interested because this is really different. Anyway, I got persuaded. They did pay me quite nicely.
Holby was a full-time job for those 6 years, from early morning till late in the evening. And now your full-time job, or nearly full-time, is looking after the grandchildren.
Yes, yes. Slightly more than I expected, to be honest with you. But circumstances are what they are.
That must be particularly nice, having had to be away a lot with your own children.
Yes, and I'm aware of the fact that I often wonder what my own children would say about their childhood. And I'm a bit nervous about asking them. Because I was away a lot. My children were born in the late 70s, 77 and 79. And in the 80s, I spent 3-4 months a year away, filming around the world. It's only in retrospect that I think, God, I had very little. It's only when I see now the responsibility of looking after two small children, which my wife and I have vicariously, that I now realise just what my wife had to do while I was filming abroad. But the joy of the two-year-old, particularly, the seven-year-old is incredibly bright. But the little two-year-old, when I arrive at my son and daughter-in-law's house and they hear the door, the two-year-old hurdles up and goes, Gumpa, Gumpa, and grabs me by the knees and gives me a hug and then grabs my hand and says, come, 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 and drags me off. So, yes, they have given me another lease of life.
We're going to play out on music, which really reminds you, I think, of one episode in a role you were playing in Holby, where you were required to prepare cocaine, and you decided that a certain song, or the scriptwriter gave you a certain song to accompany this preparation.
Yes. I think it was the Kaiser Chiefs, Ruby. Ruby, Ruby, Ruby. It was great fun. Great fun. And I don't know why they chose Ruby Ruby, but it stayed with me. And in fact, introduced me to the Kaiser Chiefs, really. And so I went out and bought albums and things like that. So, yes.
Well, that's a very nice note on which to say thank you very much indeed, Robert Powell.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Let's never be. Ruby by the Kaiser Chiefs. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions this week, the actor Robert Powell. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. As Michael said, you can find full details of all of today's music if you search for Private Passions on the Radio 3 website, and if you go to BBC Sounds, you can download hundreds of previous editions of the programme. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio, on BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers. It's 1 o'clock now, and this is John Shea with the latest BBC News. The Levelling Up Secretary, Michael Gove, has promised to ban the public sale of nitrous oxide, or laughing gas, as part of a wider crackdown on antisocial behaviour. Mr Gove said the move was aimed at preventing parks from being turned into drug-taking arenas, which he said was helping to fuel other problems. Ministers will also announce measures tomorrow to make vandals clean up the damage they cause within 48 hours. Labour said the plan amounted to nothing. A report has revealed that nearly 3,000 children, some as young as 8, were strip-searched by police under stop-and-search powers in England and Wales between 2018 and the middle of last year. The figures are being published by the Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza. She says around half of the searches took place without an appropriate adult present. Police chiefs say they will consider the findings carefully. Tunisia's Coast Guard says it has recovered 10 bodies near the coast, where two vessels trying to reach Italy sank within hours of each other. A total of 29 people are known to have died. President Biden has declared a major emergency in Mississippi, where hundreds of people have been left homeless by a tornado. 25 people died there and one in Alabama. The president's declaration allows more government funding to be freed up for recovery efforts. Ukrainian security officials have accused Russia of making Belarus a nuclear hostage after President Putin said he would station nuclear weapons there. The Secretary of the National Defence Council, Oleksiy Danilov, said the move would destabilise Belarus and deprive it of its sovereignty. Ukraine says the deployment violates non-proliferation commitments, something Mr Putin has denied. The residents of Berlin are voting in a referendum to decide whether the city should become climate neutral by the end of the decade. The measure could see the capital reach net zero before the rest of Germany. Most of Berlin's political leaders say achieving the target so quickly would hit public services because of the cost of making transport and buildings emissions-free. And the weather. This afternoon we'll see snow showers across northern parts of the UK and increasingly wintry showers along the eastern coast. High temperatures of 11 Celsius in Cardiff, 9 in London and Belfast, and 6 in Edinburgh.
Looking for something to get you through the afternoon? Why not turn to Radio 3, where every weekday we have just the right soundtrack. Riveting works by brilliant musicians from around the world with all the magic of live performance. And across this week, we hear Ryan Bancroft conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in all four symphonies by the mercurial romantic Robert Schumann. Afternoon concerts with me.